Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Welcome to Love What You Play. Today we'll be featuring a talk from our 2018 Youth Sports Summer Summit, available at followforloveofthegame.ca. Our mission is to help organizations, coaches, and sports leaders develop programs to ensure kids love the game more at the end of a season than they did at the beginning. Hi, this is Glenn Mulcahy. Thanks for joining our inaugural Digital Summit. And I'm really excited to have our next guest accept our invitation. I'm glad we were able to schedule a time to connect. Wayne Goldsmith, international sports coach who's been at it for over 30 years. His client list, and I'm going to read it from here because it is extensive. The U.S. Olympic Committee, Tennis Australia, Australian Rugby Union, Singapore Sports Council, Swimming South Africa, UK Sports Institute, Sports New Zealand, as well as many others. To work with some of the best coaches, teams, and sports organizations across the world. He's authored a new book that I'm hoping we're going to talk about a little bit, Leading Without Leading. Wayne knows a little bit, based on all the experience of working at the highest level possible. He's been to the Olympic Games, World Championships, professional football. He's also an internationally acclaimed professional speaker, has presented at summits, conferences across the world, has worked with athletes, coaches, parents, and sports executive members. Thanks for joining us, Wayne. I really appreciate making time out of your crazy schedule.
My pleasure, Glenn. I think my mother generally writes that introduction.
Yeah, it's like that whenever I get introduced. And I'm like, oh, I got to get rid of that bio. And I got to click that up and change that up. So that's why I asked you in advance. Is that where you want me to go? So that came from WG Coaching, his main platform that you'll find on the internet. So before we get
in, what I've tried in the last few seminars that I've done live is I've said, please don't introduce me. I want to walk out without an introduction and see what happens. And you should try that sometime. I actually pinched that from Jerry Seinfeld. I went and saw Jerry Seinfeld speak to do a gig here. And he walked out without being introduced. I thought that's an interesting way of doing it. That certainly confuses and then engages people. So try that sometime, walk out without being introduced and try and engage people without them knowing who you are or what you might have done.
That's a good idea. I mean, I had one where I don't know where they came across it. It was probably the first draft that somebody did for me about 8 years ago. I started listing off all this stuff that was no recurrent anymore. And so maybe without any introduction would even be better. So, but ask the same question to everybody who's been on the summit. They're all from the sports sector. They're all passionate about sport. Maybe you share a little bit of insight of what your sport pathway was in your youth and what brought you to where you are now.
I started out playing a game here called rugby league. I'm an Australian and I live on the east coast of Australia, playing a game called rugby league, which is a little bit of a hybrid, if you like, professional sport hybrid of rugby union, which might be better known in North America. And I had all intentions of playing at professional level. I loved it. And then I had a car accident when I was 15 years of age, which really badly damaged my spine. And at that point in time, I thought, well, sport's gone as a pathway, and I became very attracted to alcohol and getting in trouble, and failed my high school very, very badly and drifted into a whole range of jobs that I didn't particularly like, but they just paid the bills. So I was packing lawnmowers into big boxes, and I was working in the motor industry, and I was working in banking, and I drifted through that for about 10, 15 years. And always liked sport, like so many people, liked it, enjoyed it, but had no real connection with it. And then a chance meeting with a school friend said to me, Wayne, you're a little bit fat these days, and you used to be a bit of an athlete at school. Why don't you take up jogging? So 3 or 4 years later, I jogged, I've done some marathons, a few other things, and I couldn't get enough of sport and understanding what sport was all about, but I didn't have the education background to get into a college. But eventually, found a way of getting into college as a mature age student, studied sports science, studied coaching, and then from there it's been 25 years of working across a range of sports. From initially I was the national manager of sports science and sports medicine for Swimming Australia leading into the Sydney Olympics for 7 years, then did some consultancy work with the Australian government looking at the post-host phenomenon, looking at what nations had done leading into a home Olympics and what they had failed to do or change after hosting an Olympic Games. I went to every host nation since the Second World War to investigate that. then worked with triathlon. I was honoured to walk in the Olympic opening ceremony and closing ceremony as the leader of the Australian triathlon team. 2004, we won a medal. Should have, could have, might have done better, but we didn't. Reality high-performance sport. And since then, consulted primarily for professional football. The professional football in Australia is played across four codes, what we call Australian Football League, AFL, which is the biggest team sport here by a long way, and rugby league, rugby union, and soccer or football, and worked across basketball, netball, professional tennis, and a lot of Olympic sports. My primary focus is really coaching coaches. Of all the work that I do, my primary focus for the last really 15 years has been on helping coaches to coach more effectively.
So you're focusing more on, and we talked about briefly before we got on live, the how of coaching versus the what of coaching, and how it's kind of the whole model of shifting in Australia. Maybe explain a little bit about more about that.
Well, I think it's really important that the old days, 20 years ago, that coaches were limited by what they knew because it was hard to get information. Everything that you wanted to know about sport was owned by the sport. You could only get it from senior coaches. This thing, and it's not an ad for Apple, this thing means anyone can get anything, anytime, anywhere for free. And coaches are no longer limited by their access to knowledge. Anytime a coach says to me, I couldn't find out the information or there's nothing available about that, I have to look at them very cynically and skeptically, because you can get anything. And not only that, with social media, you are one click away from almost any coach in the world. If you want to find out what a professional coach is doing in English Premier League soccer, I am sure with a little bit of effort and a few clicks that you can get them on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. You can connect with anyone you want to. You can find out information. They're no longer the limiting factors. And people often say knowledge is power. Well, it's not. Knowledge only has value if you can't get it. Now there are no secrets in sport. Everybody knows what everybody knows. So what's the advantage that coaches have got if all knowledge is shared around the world? Well, the answer is coaching is the advantage that coaches have. So all those, what we used to call soft skills, the ability to connect emotionally with athletes, the ability to inspire commitment, the ability to teach an athlete how to be more confident, the ability to inspire the development of independence and values in athletes. That's where coaching is now. It's not about VO2 max or heart rates and lactate. I mean, that, we've gone through that era. And now with all other things being equal, it's now the advantage that coaches have is coaching.
Yeah, and in terms of how they connect with their players and the emotional intelligence, I've been fortunate through the course of these interviews, I've talked to some high-level coaches, but also some Olympic athletes. And I asked one of them, you know, what are the top characteristics that you feel of the best coaches you had? And it was ironic. There was no X's and O's and tactics and strategies, which you would think that you get to that level. It was how the coaches believed in him as an individual, how they connected, how they cared, and how they truly loved them and encouraged them to get to that level. So the how is where the world's evolving. Unfortunately, in some markets, and particularly in Canada, we're still kind of evolving to that point. Do you feel that that model, which is AKA transformational coaching, has come faster in Australia, or is it still a work in progress?
Yeah, it's still work in progress. I'm discussing this with a friend of mine, John Leonard, who's head of the World Swimming Coaches Association, a few weeks ago, and we were talking about how as a coach, as a practitioner, you're either a what coach, a how coach, or a why coach. And unfortunately, the vast majority of coaches are what coaches. Yeah. They want to know what is the strength training routine the New England Patriots are using? What is the flexibility and core stability routine used by the Cincinnati Bengals? They want to know what they're doing at top level so they can copy it. And that's the way the world wants to know the recipe. The world wants to know, what do I do? But it's the real art is in how. And I often say to people, it's like these cooking shows that are on TV. You can look at those cooking shows and you can get the recipe, then you can buy the ingredients and you can buy the same cooking equipment and kitchen appliances that they use. But what you cook is different to what you see on television. because there's an art to it and there's a timing and there's a taste.
Yeah.
This in coaching is that the what, everyone has access to the same what. So the real advantage in where coaching is, it's in the how. As you progress a little bit further, there's a very small number of coaches who start to develop an understanding of why. The importance of understanding why means that you can go from being coach who copies, and at high performance level, I say copying kills. Once you understand why you're doing things, you can then bring innovation and creativity into the process, and you can start to create your own directions and gain a real advantage. And that's the, you're like the beginning levels of coaching is what, because you don't know anything about, then you understand why, understand how, then you really get an understanding of how can I get the athlete to do that work. And I often say to coaches, I explain it like this. Everyone thinks that the secret to coaching success is what we call the content, the training session, the workouts, the flexibility routines, the core stability, the sets, the reps, volume, intensity, frequency. Everyone thinks that's the key to coaching. It's really not. It really isn't. It is when you're in your first year of coaching, but after that, it's not about those things. Every time a coach writes a workout, which is content, every time they write the content, they do it with the underlying assumption that the athletes will do the content with the intent with which it was written. Content is the science of sport. Intent is the art of coaching. My art form, if you like, is to grab the content off this,
yeah,
devices and from coaching programs, and then through my art, have the athletes willingly do the work with the intent with which it was written. Once you understand that, everything changes. Once coaches lose this blind obsession with getting more drills, more workouts, more practices, more strength training techniques, more equipment, once they lose a blind obsession with what, and they start to understand the how of coaching, everything changes for them.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The irony is that most coaching platforms that exist today focus strictly on the what, whether, and we touched on it very briefly before we got on here, the former level 1, 2, and 3s now is evolving to different models, but getting that connection piece into, you know, the instruction is not happening as fast as I would like to. I mean, that's obviously our wheelhouse. That's what we focus on and transformation. But explaining what we do and why we do it, it's the how, not the what. And everybody kind of looks at us like, huh? And I'm going, you know, how many drills can you access on the internet? You keep pulling up your phone, which I have, you know, the same thing. You can get every drill that you want in the world on your phone. You can learn from the greatest coaches in the world on how to run a practice and manage it. It's how you connect with the individual players and your teams is the key. And that's the biggest challenge that most coaches are having, because they don't have that emotional intelligence and they haven't been taught that, which sounds like it's, you're way ahead of the curve and you've been preaching that for many years. So from a coaching standpoint, are you actively coaching still, or are you working mainly on coaching coaches?
I'm mostly coaching coaches. I'm a great believer in the line that if you want to change your life, you become a coach. If you want to change the nation, coach the coaches. So I feel that where I am now with my skill set and experience, that if I work with an organisation or I work with a sport or a large school, as I was earlier in the week, that I can have a far greater effect on more people by coaching coaches. And that's what I enjoy doing. I enjoy showing coaches the importance of understanding the how and the why, and in doing so, changing lives. And it's, look, what we've basically seen, I can say this as a physiologist, I can speak ill of my own people, that the reason why the industry has been more or less based on physiology is that people love to see, measure, count, download, feel things. So I can measure heart rate and I can see 10 reps in a gym and I can see a speed through timing gates. And so much of coaching and so much of sport being based on physiology. There's more physiologists out there than there are McDonald's cooks. There are so many physiologists that's flooding. And physiology is such an appealing aspect of sport because it's around measurement. Yeah. But then if I say to somebody, and I'm talking to Dave Marsh, one of the USA swimming coaches, very successful coach of Ryan Lochte, multiple gold medal winning athlete and world champion, world record holder in medley. And David Marsh and I were talking about this just before the last Pan Pac Swimming Championships. And I said, Marshy, that our problem is if I look at an athlete and they're not strong, we can do strength work. If I see an athlete and they're not fast, we can do speed work. If I see an athlete who lacks endurance, we can do endurance work. So we know how to train those things and how to measure the difference. Until we can develop a device that measures commitment, and I figure out a way of coaching commitment or coaching confidence or coaching mental toughness or coaching resilience or coaching values and qualities, the easy thing is just to keep sticking to what we can measure, because what we measure gets done. And I would encourage coaches, and I did this the other day, again, without trying to offend any physiologists in the audience, I stood up in front of a big group of professional coaches and said, I free you from the shackles of physiology. Stop everything you do on numbers and counting. There's a great, the great Australian sports coach, Albert Einstein, is alleged to have said that, remember that not everything that counts can be counted. Not everything that's counted counts. And I often use that line when I'm talking to coaches who'll talk to me about how their athletes have got faster or increased their reps or are doing more weights. And I say, well, that's great, but does it mean they're going to be better athletes? Does it mean they'll perform better under the emotional pressure of competition? Not everything that's counts that's counted counts. Not everything that's, that counts is counted.
Yeah, and that kind of prefaces the question that I was just about to ask. One of my favorite quotes that I came across when I was watching, you did a talk and you were talking about talent identification. There's no such thing as an elite 8-year-old. And then I think you said champion 10-year-old, and I can't remember the 11-year-old. It's not part of my vocabulary. Please remove it from yours. Can you expand on why that's the case and why you feel that way?
Well, I think the parents around the sporting world, the majority of them are acting out of love. They just love their children so much. I call it the most unnatural, natural relationship in the world, because it's a level of love and sacrifice and dedication to a welfare of another human being that's hard to explain unless you're a parent yourself. And I've got four kids and I understand it very well. So parents will often do seemingly crazy things and things that don't make any sense to professionals in the business purely because they want the best for their child. It's natural and normal, isn't it, that you want your child to be happy, successful, to do things that they enjoy doing, to realize the full extent of their potential. You want those things naturally for your child. And unfortunately, when that applies to sport, as a parent wants their 9-year-old to be playing for Manchester United. And when they're 10, they want their 8-year-old to be on the next USA Olympic swimming team. They want their 12-year-old to be playing for the Cleveland Cavaliers next year, because that, in their mind, is going to give their kids everything that they want. And time and time again, and I'd almost say I've been preaching this for 25 to 30 years around the world, early rise, early fall. Those kids that are exceptionally talented, those kids that are great at 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years of age, rarely, rarely make it to elite senior level, professional level, Olympic Games competition. And when I say that, someone's always got an outlier. Someone will say, oh, yeah, but what about Lionel Messi, who was a great football player when he was 10? I mean, he's won in hundreds and hundreds of millions of players over the last. To assume that your child is on the same path as someone who's done that remarkable thing, or someone will say, well, Michael Phelps was a pretty good swimmer at 14. Now, again, the greatest Olympian since 1896, those outliers are interesting, but you can't include them in the way that you think about or help your child to develop. The overwhelming message for parents is parent them first. Love them unconditionally, value them and accept them for who they are, not for what they do. Be there for them all the time. Listen to them. Be around them. Provide them guidance. Help them to develop qualities like independence. Help them to develop self-responsibility. Help them to accept accountability for things they say and do and don't say and don't do. Help them to be outstanding human beings. If they've got any talent, that'll shine through. I often say to parents, you don't need to do a lab test to find talent. Real talent is harder to hide than it is to find. You don't have to be a genius to see talented kids. It's not about talent. It's about all those factors, those human qualities, those values, virtues, and character traits. That's what it's really all about. And if you develop those, which is really the responsibility of parents, and the child has any talent at all, that'll start coming through in their mid-teens and they'll have everything they need to do. And I often say to parents that one of the jobs that I do, I get asked to go and work with professional football teams around the world. I never get asked, how do I help this athlete be a better athlete or run faster or get stronger? It's always around attitude, values, responsibility, professionalism, selflessness. It's always around those qualities. They are the cornerstone of excellence. It's not about size, strength, speed, power. It's about being holistically, being the best human being that you can be.
Yeah, and basically, in a nutshell, how coachable they will be versus other players. Like what I found with a lot of, I call the prima donnas, usually the top skilled athletes in earlier age groups, they usually start thinking that it's just going to come to them naturally. Nothing, then the work ethic's not going to be there. But that tortoise and the hare concept, you know, the tortoise eventually will catch up to the hare, early bloomer versus late bloomer. And there's been a lot of research now of how the late bloomers have been neglected based on many of the funnels that we've had in various countries worldwide, India being one of them. They almost basically eliminate all of their potential talent athletes by the time they're 10, 11 years old. So that's why their pipeline is so skinny, instead of, you know, continuing to build it all the way up through the funnel.
Yeah, it's you're exactly right. I often think that in all probability, the majority of professional athletes and Olympic champions are not the best athletes in the country. They're the ones that have been left standing, the ones that had a love of the sport and a passion and a determination to succeed in spite of the systems. Because you're exactly right. Those junior representative teams, oh God, we've got to get rid of junior representative sporting teams, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years of age. They're doing more harm to sport than sport even realises. So you're exactly right. So you have a 10-year-old child, a group of 10-year-old children make the under-11 junior representative for Ohio or something like that. And all the parents of those kids are really excited, and those kids are really excited. However, the data says that none of those kids will ever play senior professional soccer at any level. The kids who don't make that team think, well, hang on, I'm not in the junior representative team, therefore I'm never going to be any good at soccer. I think I'll go to baseball, basketball, football, Olympic sports, or nothing, and just drop out of sport altogether. The value of those junior representative teams, to me, is nil. But we persist with it because we've always done it. And it's very difficult to go to a state or a national body and sell them on the concept, hey, guys, the data says, the parents say, the feedback is, this is not helping our sport. It's not increasing participation, and it's not helping at elite level. We've got to change it. Politically, very difficult to pull off.
You think it's going hand in hand, and I don't know what it's like in Australia, but in the US particularly, the professionalism of youth sports has really evolved. The industry, when I first started doing what I'm doing now, 8, 9 years ago, the business sector identified youth sports as around a $7 billion industry. Fast forward 8 years later, it's more than doubled. It's now been identified over $15 billion based on a Time article last year. Is the same kind of trend holding true in Australia, where the professionalism, because of the junior rep teams, that where people want their kids because they think they're going to get to that level?
Yeah, follow the money. You're exactly right. Always follow the money. Human instinct and human behavior doesn't change anywhere, never has. But we're talking, Glenn, you and I, as professionals that are working across sport as an industry and trying to make some wholesale changes on the way things have done. If I was the national coaching director for the NFL, for example, and someone said, your job is to grow the sport, I would probably, although it would hurt me ethically, but to keep my job, the smartest thing I can do would be to have 8-year-old NFL junior elite development programs and say to the parents, hey, this kid is 8, but he's only one step off playing for the Broncos. Yeah, this kid could be anything, because the parents are so vulnerable about anything to do with where their children are concerned, that if I came in and I could leave my ethics outside the door for a little while, I would absolutely have elite junior high performance NFL programs starting at six. I mean, because I want to capture that audience and keep them paying fees and paying money and buying boots and shoulder pads and gear and helmets. And I want to keep them connected to the game, bringing as much money into that program as possible. And I believe what we're seeing, and I mean, one of the issues we know, Glenn's happening around the world, is the data, certainly in Australia, Canada, the UK, New Zealand, and several other places, is that the number of kids involved in competitive sport is declining, certainly the Olympic sports particularly, but all sports, we're seeing significant declines in the number of kids doing competitive sport. Increasingly, the sporting bodies are becoming more possessive of those kids already in their pathway. And I suspect that what will happen is the big players, the NFLs, the NBAs, the NHLs, and Australia are similar sort of national governing bodies around the professional codes, will extend their claws further down the age groups to try and hang on to talented athletes and families, start them earlier and connect with them for a longer period of time. I think there'll be a period where the market says who can get the majority of kids and hang on to them. That, of course, is going to spell disaster for the Olympic sports because they won't have the resources and they won't have the capacity to stretch out into, you know, primary schools and junior high schools and so on. So I suspect there's going to be appropriate on this day with what's happening in Singapore. There may be a little bit of a war going on between sports to try and get talent and hang on to it longer and get onto it earlier.
Is that why you feel that the early specialization model is the I think it was, you said, the road to doom?
It really is. We know that if, and I often say this to parents, if you allow your child to be defined by what they do and they can no longer do that thing, you're condemning them to failure in that sport. So what I mean by that, typically what happens in swimming, a sport that I'm very closely connected with, that if a child wins a 50-meter breaststroke race, it's tempting for the coach, for the athlete, and for their parent to say, this is my son, the breaststroker. And they get introduced to other people. Hey, this is my son, the breaststroker. He's always winning breaststroke. So they turn 9 and 10, and they're getting better at breaststroke. And all of a sudden at 11, this part of their arm grows at a different rate to that part, or their body proportions change, and they can no longer swim breaststroke. So the child's getting frustrated. They're not winning anymore. Mum and dad, of course, blame the coach. That's fairly typical in sport. The kid's doing well, it's genetics. If they're doing poorly, it's the coach. And the parent takes them to another coach who says, I'll try a different method, I'll try something else. This is my son, the breaststroker. This is my... And the child has started to believe that the way their parents think about them and the way that the world sees them and the way they see themselves is about their breaststroke. So all of a sudden, they can't breaststroke anymore. Self-esteem gets damaged. They believe that their relationship with their parent is being under all the things that we don't want to happen starts to happen. And they typically go 12, 13, 14, and they go, well, I could never do breaststroke anymore. I'm going to drop out. And I must get an email every day from around the world from a parent with that story. Wayne, hi, I just want to talk to you about my child. When they were 8, they were really good at cricket or basketball or whatever. At 9 and 10, they were in all the junior rep teams and they were on a path of glory. At 11 and 12, they had some problems. We changed coaches, but they were still doing very well. Now they're 14 and they want to drop out of the sport. Can you motivate my child? I get every day, United States, Europe, everywhere, I get an email like that. And I say to the parents, I'm sorry, I can't. It's the story you're telling me, it's gone, it's gone. Step back, love them. If they come back, they come back. If they don't, they don't. You can't motivate teenagers to do anything. I often say that trying to motivate teenagers is like teaching a pig to sing. You'll only motivate yourself.
That's a great analogy.
But you can't motivate. You know, I say to parents, one of the most common things I get asked to do, and it pays the mortgage, is to do motivation talks. And I do them, but I don't believe in them for a moment. Just don't tell anybody. That motivation is a fire that's burning inside all of us. And it's been in there more than likely since the child was 5, 6, 7, 8 years of age. And it's just waiting for a moment and an opportunity for someone to throw some petrol on it so the fire bursts forward and their talent is expressed. You can't impose motivation on people. You can inspire people, or you can create environments and opportunity for that motivation to be expressed. But you can't force kids who don't want to do something, who've had enough, who can't see a way forward. You can't turn them around and motivate them to go back and find that love and that passion for what they were doing. So the key is to make sure the love and the passion is there to begin with.
Yeah, and that's the whole reason why we founded our online extension of Paradigm Sports is for love of the game. Because I was talking with my counterparts and I said, other than, the parental and the coaches screaming at kids, why are kids quitting? It's not just because they're not having fun anymore. When I grew up, I loved sports. I loved every sport. I played everything under the sun, whether it was organized or free play. And my whole generation, that's what our life was. And then that was pre-internet. But once the internet started evolving, things started eroding to this, two sports, maybe three, and then now one sport. But kids don't love that sport to carry them forward into adulthood, and they're burning out early and earlier. So the trends in Canada and the U.S., and I believe the U.K. is a little less, but percentage of kids that are quitting sports in Australia, is it similar to our 60-70% trend?
It's getting higher. It's the trend seems to be that there's a decline in the number of kids playing competitive sport in that early to mid-teens particularly. It's always been bad, but it's getting worse. The sports that are experiencing it the most, the big time commitment sports, swimming, athletics, gymnastics, diving, ice skating, all those big time commitment, intrusive to family type sports, yeah. Rowing, distance cycling, all those sports. And the worst of all is rural and regional areas for Olympic sports, because they don't generally have the resources,
right,
the coaches, the facilities and so on that the cities do. So that really is the trend. And it would be fair to say it's the biggest issue in competitive sport around the world at the moment, is the declining numbers of kids doing competitive sport. And we know in some sports and some of the Olympic sports in Australia, the number of kids in competitive clubs space has declined 50 to 60% since the 1990s.
Wow.
So a sport like gymnastics here is about 60% down on the number of kids competing in that sport from where it was 15 to 20 years ago. And if you believe in that pyramid structure of sport, if you're at Olympic level and you're selecting an Olympic team from 60% fewer competitive athletes, it's going to affect you at top level as well. It's going to have a massive effect. Certainly in a place like Australia, we've only got 25, 26 million people.
Yeah.
We need every possible opportunity to engage with talented athletes and help them to be all they can be. We can't afford to have the huge decline in our base that maybe some of the other nations can. So it's going to hurt us very, very badly.
Yeah, and similar trend is going to hold true in Canada, because we're not much larger. We're about 35 million. I know the U.S., even with their 350 million, are concerned about the attrition of the base, whether you call it the pyramid or if you call the numbers going feeding into that top level. But those numbers are declining rapidly. And the biggest challenges we all face is, how do we turn that corner? So what are you doing in Australia to help coaches invigorate the love, the passion for the game for kids to go beyond that 13, 14-year-old age group?
What I've seen over the last few years, Glenn, is what sports are typically doing around the world is, when they see the declining standards, they do what every business around the world does, every business in every industry. When they see declining numbers of clients, they do advertising and marketing campaigns. So we've seen all that, where their sports have advertised the positive qualities of being a football player or a tennis player or so on. That really hasn't addressed the situation. What we've then seen sports do is come up with these modified games, 2-on-2 soccer and 5-on-5 rugby and, NFL with two kids and a kangaroo. We've seen everything. Everyone, because normally what the sports have done, they've gone to marketing companies and sport business companies who've come up with these really left-field creative ideas in their think tanks and said, well, what you guys need to do is market the sport and try this modified version of the sport. I think it's the wrong way to go. There's nothing wrong with your sport. There's nothing wrong with netball, basketball, hockey. There is nothing wrong with sport. It's the way it's been delivered.
Yes.
So with that, who is delivering sport? Coaches and officials. And the reason, in my view, why we're seeing the decline in sport around the world is that coaching is generally terrible, and the way we've developed, and I take responsibility for it, as a coach developer for 25 years, we have done a terrible job developing coaches. We've got several generations of coaches that we have developed around the world. We've put them through coaching courses that were way too sports science heavy, that didn't have the sort of content and syllabus conducive of teaching coaches how to connect with families, how to inspire young athletes, how to create positive experience. We trained them that coaching was all about physiology, biomechanics, skill acquisition, nutrition and psychology. We didn't coach coaches to coach. And now we're looking at a workforce that's poorly prepared to deliver the experience of sport the way it needs to be delivered. And I think, you know, if anyone's watching this who's from a sport, stop wasting millions of dollars on modified sport programs and marketing and advertising programs. Invest in your coaches and in coaching, because they're delivering the sports experience. They're the ones who have the relationship with the athletes and the families. Like the example I used here, I spoke at the World Rugby Union Conference last year, and I said, just imagine for a moment that we're watching on television the greatest game of rugby union that anyone's ever seen. And the final score is 100-99. And the All Blacks have won. They've beaten.
Of course the All Blacks won.
Of course the All Blacks win. Always do. But just imagine it's the greatest match. We haven't seen running like this and skill, and it's remarkable. And every little boy and every little girl in the world decides that they want to play the game of rugby. Yeah. They're excited by that, what they've seen on television. So they go into the local club. And there's old John there, who's run that club for 35 years, has been a player, then a coach, life member, been on the committee. And these little 8-year-old, 9-year-old boys and girls walk into the club and say, I'm so excited about rugby. I want to play rugby. And John looks at him and says, off you go, 4 laps. You've got to warm up. Because we taught him at our coaching courses since the 1980s around the world, those level 1, 2, 3 courses, we taught him that every athlete has to do a warm up. And the little kids come back and they say, what can we do now? We want to play. We want to play. And John says, now you've got to do core stability work and flexibility work, because that's what I learned at my recent coaching course, in my coaching convention. You've got to engage your rectus abdominis muscles and get them connected. Then they do drills. And some coaches, because of what we taught them, have got more drills than a hardware store. That's all they know.
Yeah.
Then do some speed work, then they do modified games. And just before they go, John, in our club example, says, let's have a quick game before you leave. The one reason the kids came to the club was to play
that game.
Give them. It's like being a vegetarian and going into a steak restaurant. And you say, look, I want a vegetarian meal. I say, sorry, we're only selling steak. Yes, but I want a vegetarian meal. I love vegetarian food. I want a vegetarian meal. No, we only sell steak. That's what you're going to have. You go to another restaurant, or you go home and you don't eat at all. That what we're doing is we're getting kids excited about the game or about sport, but what we're actually delivering them through coaches and officials is nothing like what they're seeing. And until we realize that it's our responsibility as coach educators and coaches' responsibility to create positive, exciting, engaging experiences for kids, it's not going to change. It's just not going to change.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And one of the other challenges from a marketing perspective, if you look at the one segment for kids that is growing exponentially tenfold, the e-gaming whole video game industry. And what are they doing differently? They, every time they launch a game, they survey the kids, they ask them what they can do to improve the game. game after game just gets better and better, the whole interaction, the engagement process. And the other part of the equation is there's not a parent, there's not a coach, there's no officials. It's they own the experience. And if they fail when they play that game, all they're doing is pressing the reset button to play over and over again. So exactly. That whole model is flourishing because they're marketing it to that end user, the avatar. But and most organizations are focusing it to the parents, the marketing monies won't have you. So I don't disagree whatsoever. And, you know, coaching is improving, but we still have a long ways to go to make sure that that experience is a positive one for the kids, so that they're saying, hey, oh, I want to play this game because I enjoy it. I love the coach. I love my teammates and all that other good stuff. So,
yeah, look, exactly right. And it's common sense, isn't it? But there's a great line that says, funny thing about common sense, it's not very common. That, I mean, look at two contrasting models. So a 10-year-old soccer player goes down to what I call a traditional soccer program, football program. They walk in and they run laps. They do drills. They dribble the ball between cones. They do passing drills. They do shooting drills. And they play a game at the end for 5 minutes. Alternate model. The kids turn up. I put one of the mums in one of the goals, one of the dads in the other goal. And as soon as they arrive, we start playing. 5 against 5, 6 against 6, and me as coach on the field running around with them. We do that for 10 or 15 minutes. I might see that they can't pass with their left foot, so I stop the game and we do 2 minutes of left-footed passing, fun drills with each other, and then we start the game again. This time I swap two players over and change direction. We play for another 10 or 15 minutes. We stop, we have a drink. We have a two-minute discussion. We go back, we play the game again. I go along and say, well, none of these kids can strike the ball. All right, let's stop and have 2 to 3 minutes of shooting practice. Let's go back to the game again. Bring out two more parents on either side and they can get involved with the kids' game. That's option B. Option A is dying. If you're coaching that way and you're worrying about why you don't have so many kids, I'm sorry, it's your fault. Option B, connected, engaged, vigorous, kid-focused, flowing, relatively short, dynamic. The game is their teacher. The drills aren't their teacher. And right. The rectus abdominis engagement exercises is not their teacher. No one lies in bed at night dreaming of doing drills better. They lie in bed at night dreaming about playing more with their friends. And if we're not giving that to them, obviously in some sort of meaningful, structured way, around helping them get better, there's still got to be some common sense around it. Yeah. But that old model, which we taught them to do and which they've believed is the way that everyone must coach, that's not a sport. And that's one of the main reasons, I believe, for the decline in the number of kids. This other way, just letting the game be their teacher and the game flowing through everything, it's more like the E version of sport, and that's more likely to be conducive of keeping kids playing.
Yeah, it's the whole coaching on the fly concept. Like whenever I've been running practices over the last, I probably went to this model about 10 plus years ago, I got rid of my whistle. And I started calling out, hola! And that's what we had to kind of regroup. Okay, we need to work on this specific skill for, like I said, 2 minutes. Let's keep playing. And that's what kids want. They just want to come out and be active. In my past youth with the free play, growing up in Montreal, hockey was big for us. I mean, and we actually had a lot of outdoor rinks, and that's what we grew up on. But a lot of times when those rinks were empty, they were full. They were full of kids that were just playing shinny and playing for hours and hours on end, playing. The emphasis on the word playing versus, you know, Wade Gilbert's got a great quote. When's the last time that your kid came to you and said, Mom, Dad, can I work hockey? Can I work basketball, which is a year-round phenomenon with a specialization? No, they ask you, can I play? And that's what they want to do. They want to play. I mean, once they get to the 16, 17, 18, and they've kind of zeroed in on a sport they want to focus on, okay, then it becomes a little more structured. But up until 12, 13, look at Norway, a perfect example, where they don't allow competition until they're 13.
Yeah, exactly right. And you got to think longer term as well, that a lot of those, the bottom line is for the majority of people in the world, that sport will always be something they did when they were children. So majority of people, by the time they get to college or they're working, they're more into fitness and health and well-being than they are into competitive sport. However, if their experience of sport was positive and if they really love their sport, when their parents and their little boy or little girl says, "Hey, Dad, I'd like to do basketball," and Dad says, "Man, I love basketball. I had this great coach. He was such a great coach. Believed in me. Practices were exciting. Some of my best friends were from my basketball years." Dad takes the child back to basketball. If on the other side, Dad says, "I hate basketball. I had this coach and we worked all the time and we ran nonstop and we did nothing but drills and it was boring and the coach was rude. Man, you're not going to basketball. You're going to football because I hate," you know, it's got creating these positive experiences as a multi-generational effect that even if a particular child doesn't end up playing for the NBA, the child of that child might end up playing for the NBA or the child of the grandchild might end up. And it all comes down to the fact that when they're as a family talking about their sports experience, they relate back to how wonderful that sport was and how great that coach was. That's what they're looking for. It's a multi-generational, much broader than just getting one athlete to the top of that sport.
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of precursor to my next question. What would you feel would be the top three characteristics of great coaches?
Of great coaches? Yeah. The capacity to inspire through emotional connection. So to really connect with athletes and to really inspire change. There's a lot of people talk and a lot of people present and a lot of people have got big ideas. But in the end, coaching is change. In one word, coaching is change. And the art form of coaching is to be able to inspire change in athletes through emotional connection by connecting with them. Difference to me between someone who's running a fitness training business, which is on repeats and just yelling and screaming and doing work. Coaching is about that art of inspiring change through emotional connection. A genuine commitment to lifelong learning. You have to see learning opportunities in everything and every moment. So genuine commitment to continuous improvement, lifelong learning, getting better at what you do. Often say to coaches, your rate of learning and your rate of professional development must be faster and greater than that of the athlete. If you want to remain relevant, particularly in these days with information being so easily available, your rate of learning has got to be superior to the rate of learning of your athletes or you'll be made redundant and irrelevant very, very quickly. You have no option but to do that. And thirdly is you've got to do what I call the three L's, look, listen, and love. You've got to look at really what's happening in the lives of your athletes, listen to them intently, and you have to love your athletes and have to love what you're doing. So I do a lot of work with high-performance sport, and I was doing a session a little while ago with the professional swimming team in the USA, and I said to them that typically when we talk high performance, we talk about words like relentless and commitment and ambition and passion and drive, and all those things are important, but just as important are words like love, selflessness, caring, value, and acceptance of your teammates. The coaches have got to be comfortable in those three areas.
I don't disagree in it, with all those. What do you feel about in terms of coaches preaching or reinforcing the importance, in addition to, you know, life lessons like we talked about? What about respect and sportsmanship? Do you think that's something that has eroded? I've seen a lot of that disappear in Canada. I don't know what it's like in Australia.
Yeah, well, generally in society, it's some of those values are not as well supported through the family structure or through schools even. So it's interesting to note that quite often when I go and work with professional football teams or professional sporting teams, one of the most commonly asked things I get asked to do, my most common contracts, are helping the team and the athlete group come up with a set of values that they can connect with and they can buy into, that they can identify with. And I go through the most common value that comes out of those processes over a long, long period of time in many sports is the word honesty. They want to talk about honesty. And I believe in the phrase that as the twig is bent, so shall it grow. But all those characteristics like honesty, sincerity, humility, courage, discipline, selflessness, respect, all those things are values which should have been developed and enhanced and embraced by the parents That's why parent education is so critically important. And that's the foundation of, and parents and the role of parents has never been so important. If parents understand their job is not to coach and not to try and turn their child into the next NFL star, their job is to teach values, unconditional love and acceptance. Those things are what parents can do, and only parents can do, and those things will then underpin the child's success in sport and in life.
I agree. And one of the biggest challenges that I face and talking to organization after organization is having them understand the importance of that parent education. They'll allocate tons of money, like almost every sport I talk to, invest tons and tons in their budgets for skill development of their players. Very little for coaching development and nothing for parent education. And they're the biggest stakeholder. They're the ones that are paying for their kids to be part of that organization. They should have an understanding of the core values and mission statement, why their kids are playing and what have you. But those sports organizations, not now, there'll be more kids coming into that pipeline. Well, now they're starting to see that those kids are not coming to the pipeline. So everybody's panicking. Parent education is key.
Yeah, no doubt. I do tours, different parents of the world, just doing parent education workshops. And quite often I've had 400 or 500 people in the audience, and it's growing. I think you're right. There's a great phrase I love, which says most people don't change until it's too late or until it's almost too late. Sports probably knew they needed to invest in coaches and coach development 10 years ago, but nobody did because they thought, well, you know, coaching's a little bit like witch doctory that, you know, what do, and national sporting organisations didn't really want to get too involved. And I quite often ask CEOs of national sporting organisations, what percentage of budget do you spend on coach development? Very, very rarely is it more than about 2% at most. They'll all tell you that coaching and coach development is a critical priority, but they don't spend money on it, and parenting is even less. It's interesting, though, that over the next 6 to 12 months, that three of the largest and, I'd say, most advanced Western sporting nations are about to invest very heavily in parent education programs from a national government level. That's coming there because, again, they realise that their back's against the wall. They've got to do something differently. Yeah. And it'll be what I would call parent education will be the flavour of the month for the next few years. But increasingly, I suspect that sporting nations will also realise that if coaching is a priority and you're only spending about 2% or less of budget on training, educating, developing coaches, it's like saying that your family's health and nutrition is the most important thing to you, but you spend less than 2% on fresh fruit, vegetables, meat and dairy. How can you say that coaches and coaching is critically important and spend no money on it? That you can't, if you're not resourcing it, clearly it's not that important to you. So that we've got to turn that around.
Yeah, and until that mindset shifts, where I think a big driver for that is the outcome base of the wins and losses thinking, the only way that we're going to win games is we can focus on increasing the skill of the players. But if you have great coaches, they can do that. You won't need to develop the skill through an outside source body. So it's kind of like a vicious circle. It is slowly but changing, but not at the pace that it should be, because we're losing kids. And I think as a world, as a global entity, we've let this generation of kids down. And we need to figure out a way how to move that needle like really fast. We can't just keep doing this because that's just not helping the cause. And too many kids are going to suffer health issues and all kinds of stuff. It's going to be a major strain on the health system if we don't address it soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you on that. And again, it's a broken record, but to me, it's the end user. It's the connection between, to most families and most kids, the sport is the coach. I'm sure that 99% of kids playing Little League couldn't tell you who the commissioners of the Major League Baseball are, and they couldn't tell you who the owners are of the any of the NBA teams or the NBL team. They couldn't tell you that. But they can tell you everything about their coach. They know their coach. They can tell you what car they've got, their favourite food, how they like their burgers, the sport is the coach for the majority of people in the sport. And it makes sense then to be driving this change and this culture that we want to see shift in sport. It makes sense to be driving that through coaches.
So would that be your tip for to ensure that kids love the game more at the end of the season than they did at the beginning, or is there any others you could share?
Yeah, love it all the way through. And to teach parents and coaches that there is no difference between winning and losing. And I know that's very hard to get your head around. So as an example, I was talking to a high-performance coaching group the other day, and I said, guys, if your team wins by 20 points, what do you do the next day? And they said, we get up, we get together, we work really hard at improving. And so what do you do if your team loses by 30 points? Well, we get up the next day and we get there and we work really hard. Win or losing as a professional coach, there's no difference to what we actually do. It makes a difference to the athletes, maybe, but and to the fans. But really in coaching, winning or losing shouldn't make any difference at high performance level, at professional level, to what we do. The way I translate that to coaches and parents with junior athletes is the way you feel about the kids, the way you coach, the way you love the kids, no difference win or lose. If the kid scores the winning goal and it's the last game of the season and they win the trophy, love them unconditionally and congratulate them. If the kid misses the final goal and it costs them the season, love them unconditionally, buy them an ice cream, tell them you're proud of watching, makes no difference. The way you feel about them as a parent, the way you respond to them as a parent, the way you respond to them as a coach, winning or losing has no difference. And then the kids fall in love with the experience. They don't fall in love with winning and losing. They fall in love with the experience. There's kids that are going to compete. One of the things I always do when I'm talking with parents about kids who are in that 16, 18 years, so they're the ones that have made a commitment to high performance. I often say to them, who thinks their kid's got a will to win? And they all put their hand up and I say, I'm going to tell you something. Will to win's worth nothing. The great athletes I work with hate losing. They just hate losing.
Yeah.
But it doesn't affect how they feel about themselves. So the best athletes I see, when they lose, they don't go, I'm terrible, I'm awful, it always happens to me. They don't do that because they've been taught from an early age and winning or losing has got nothing to do with them and their self-esteem, their self-belief. All it is learning experience. Where parents have gone, I love you a lot, I reward you greatly when you win, and I treat you differently when you lose, the kids then start to develop an attitude that unless they win, unless it's perfect, they feel differently about themselves. Very difficult for those athletes to be successful long-term. Whereas the good athletes that I work with in all sports, common characteristic, they hate losing with a passion, but they use that hatred to work harder, inspire them more, give more commitment. It doesn't affect how they feel about themselves. It just makes them want to work harder to be better. Parents have got to understand that.
Yeah, and that's the biggest driver. You know, a lot of people think because of my philosophy is promoting fun and positivity that I'm not one that is extremely competitive. I hate losing on every front, but I won't jeopardize kids to win games. Infamous short benches that would have. So
the only child who can't improve is the one who's not there. That's the simplest line I can give. If the child is not there, they can't get better.
Okay, so rapid fire questions. We're kind of getting near the end of our little chat, and appreciate it. What's your favorite book that you would recommend to coaches other than the one you just wrote, which I'm going to endorse and we'll plug it at the end? We didn't actually get a chance to tag on to that. So favorite book you would recommend and maybe chat a little bit about why you wrote the recent book.
I tend to read books that are a little broader than coaching. I tend to look at books around things like creativity and innovation. I don't generally read biographies because I think they're there to sell product or to sell speaking engagements. Yep. So, yeah, look, I read a wide range. I read that book recently about Make Your Bed, which I thought was a really good book written by an ex-Navy SEAL about doing the simple things right early in the morning, the importance of teaching values and virtues. So at the moment, that's the book that I'm recommending to parents particularly is that book is Make Your Bed. Excellent read, very easy to read. but just about the simplicity of simple discipline, routines, and really interesting read, really good.
And it's basically, in essence, starting the day the right way and carry forward throughout the rest of the day.
Which is a great line I got from a mountaineer once: the way you do anything is the way you do everything. And it was from a mountaineer about to do Mount Everest. And he held a session, training session for some of the mountaineers, and two of the guys were late to the first session, and he threw them off the team and said, "I don't want to put my life in your hands at 28,000 feet above sea level. You guys can't get here across traffic. The way you do anything is the way you do everything. Chances are you'll tie a bad knot." And I've never forgotten that. So a very similar theme: the way you do anything is the way you do everything.
Yeah, brilliant. Tell us a little bit about your book so we can get a plug in for you.
Oh, look, thanks very much. Yeah, I've written a book called Leading Without Leading. Subtitle, at last, the book that teaches you how to lead by not doing it. And it came out of, I was working with a professional football team here in Australia, and there was an Indigenous player, an Aboriginal Australian Indigenous player. And by nature, he was very shy and very quiet. And the team decided that they wanted to put him on the leadership group. And I said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And they said, "Well, we've got a leadership, a management consultancy group who does leadership training." And I said, "Well, what's that entail?" They said, "Well, he does public speaking and he'll learn strategic planning." And I said, "Guys, no, that's not him. It's not the way that he connects with human beings. He's a tremendous communicator, but in his own way and one-on-one." And I thought for a while that, you know, with leadership, we've always done the same stuff. We've always got people together and we've said leadership is A, B, C, D. Or here's some examples of great leaders. Here's Churchill and Kennedy and Patton. And give me examples of what leadership is. And we've showed them how to do public speaking. The greatest leadership is very subtle and it's very quiet. And quite often it's one person connecting with another human being, and in doing so, very subtly and quietly influencing their attitudes and behavior. That's where leadership really is. And that means that anyone can be taught to do that. So in the case of that football player, what we would do with him is he would take a player to the other side of the training field and they would just kick the football to each other. And while he was there, he would talk very quietly, very intimately, one-on-one, and he would get behavior to change. And he was the most powerful and effective leader in the team, even though he was the shyest and most quiet. And by traditional measures, people would say, "Well, because he's not a good orator, he can't lead." So I decided there was time for a book that looked at leadership from that perspective. Instead of saying to kids, for to be a leader, you've got to be influential over a large group and you've got to be a great communicator. Well, no, let's let people be comfortable with who they are, be very comfortable with who they are as a human being. Teach them the art of inspiring change through connection, through connecting with other human beings, and how to then very subtly change attitudes and behavior through that way. And that's the whole essence of the book, is be yourself, believe in who you are, and use that authenticity and genuineness to then influence the behaviors of others.
I think it's going to be a great read. I tried to get it in time before this talk, but I had to order it through a publisher or through somebody else. So I'm looking forward to reading it, and I'll definitely make sure we plug it below the video.
Thanks. Let me know what you think.
What would be your, because you've also done a lot of talks with sports parents and work. Is there any book that you would recommend for parents to go to?
Look, not really. There's a lot of books that are available on the market about parenting in general and the importance of quality parenting around time management, around teaching self-responsibility, about teaching accountability. There's a lot around. I've got a book in progress on sport and parenting. I know there's a few that are in development by different people in the industry around the world at the moment. But you know, look, with parents, if you Google great parenting, parenting boys, parenting teenagers, there's so much there. It's just a matter of listening to it, looking at it, reading everything you can. But in the end, I ask parents this one thing. I say, close your eyes and take some deep breaths. And I want you to imagine you're walking down the street 20 years from now and coming the other way is your son or your daughter. And imagine that you walk up to them. Tell me what you see. And when I ask this in my workshops and in my presentations, parents immediately will say, I saw them smiling, I saw them healthy, I saw them happy, I saw them being a good parent, I saw them with a partner that they cared about. I say, did anyone see them with a football under their arm? No. Did anyone see them with an Olympic gold medal around their neck? No. Did anyone see them getting out of Ferrari? No. So, well, in the end, what you want as a parent is happiness, connection with them, a good relationship with them, so they become good parents. The other stuff is not that important, really. When it comes down to it, what you want, what every parent wants, are those things. So give that to them. That's really all they need to think about. If they stay focused on that and not on how far they can kick or how good their backhand is or how fast their freestyle is, then they'll do a great job as parents.
And basically our role as parents is help them evolve into becoming well-rounded people and great contributors to society. If we've done that, then we've accomplished our goal. So
that's all we can hope for.
So from a coach perspective, what would be the number one tip that you would share for coaches that are just getting started, maybe, and depending on the certification programs, help them shave 5 years off their learning curve? What would it be?
Find yourself a good psychotherapist, because you're probably going to need it at some stage. I'm lucky that I'm married to one who was also an elite athlete. So that helps me tremendously. The easiest thing in the world is put the athletes first. Just put relationships with the athletes first. Relationship with the parents a very close second, and then worry about the other stuff later. I rarely, when we hire young coaches to work with athletes, I rarely go on qualifications. I go on who they are as a human being. If I sit there with them, and I remember a specific example that I was hiring for an assistant swimming coach, and the first person walked in, had a huge resume, had done all the study, had done all the background projects, had coached this and coached that, and had a whole bit. But talking to them, I felt depressed. They just told me about all the things that were wrong with the sport. They told me difficulties of coaching, all the hardships of coaching, dealing with parents. I felt I was depressed after that. I felt like I needed to go and get myself a six-pack and drown my sorrow. And I felt bad, and I thought, man, if they're making me feel bad, how bad are they going to make my 10-year-olds feel?
Yeah.
The next person walked in was a university student. And she walked in and she said, hi, Wayne. It's great to be here. Oh, thanks for fitting me in. It's so good. I've always loved her. First connection was upbeat, positive, happy, personable, honest. And then she said, look, I don't have any background in coaching, but I just love it. I can't wait to be around kids. I'm doing kindergarten teaching at school. I love walking in a class. And I went, man, that's the person I need in this business, because her love and her care of human beings and who she is shines through everything. And so we brought her in and we trained her how to be a coach. But she had that spark and that connection with human beings that you can't buy. So my advice to every coach, put that first. The other stuff, that's what this is for.
Yeah, great takeaway, because all that skills, drills, tactics, strategies, you're right, it's on that foam. So going into the latter half of 2018, 2019, what are some of the big projects that you're working on?
I'm working on an interesting project at the moment for swimming in Australia, where the national body, in its great wisdom, has asked for the development of a national coaching strategy from the first steps through to master swimming, so that the development of coaches is aligned to the overall organisational goals. Really, you would think that was common sense to do that, but there's not a lot of organisations have actually said, hey, what's our sport look like? What's our broad organisational goals look like? All right, now let's train our coaches. Let's train, educate, develop our coaches to deliver what we're looking for as a workforce to help us achieve our strategic organisational objectives. It's been enjoyable. It's been really, really enjoyable. Working with another professional sporting body here, professional football group, on developing a professional license structure, but focusing on developing a holistic development of athletes. I've got a tour plan for New Zealand later in the year, focused on sport and parenting. And if things go well, from the 14th of December, for 2 weeks, I'll be in Japan with my family having a holiday. But yeah, a lot of things to do between now and then, and hopefully a book out around October, and I'll keep plugging away on that. And I've just done a set of 25 short videos really aimed at leadership, and part of that is support the book that's come out, Leading Without Leading, but decided that the next series of videos will be around leadership and developing leaders. So that'll all come out over the next 4 or 5 months as well.
The short videos, are they through your WG coaching platform or through another?
If you go to WG coaching, if you go to YouTube WG coaching, I think it's YouTube/WG coaching. There's around 70 short videos on continuous improvement, on parenting, on the coaching process, on winning coaching, and can you coach winning? There's around 70 short videos. I love it if people subscribe, but they're free. And just if people go and look and connect and give me some feedback, I'd appreciate it.
Great. And so other than the YouTube channel, what are the social media platforms can people follow you and see your great stuff?
So if you go to wgcoaching.com initially, that'll then lead you through to Facebook platform and then Twitter and LinkedIn. I'm finding that LinkedIn is a great place to connect. There's so many professionals around the world that are not just sharing what they're doing, but they're finding things, news items that are relevant to coaches and coaching and sport. This, I think if you shape LinkedIn well, it's a tremendous learning and sharing platform. The downside is that once you start to build a bit of an audience, you get a lot of sales stuff trying to connect with you so they can sell product through your network. You'd be a little bit careful with that, but the nature of life, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel your pain, and we shared that at exchange of emails. And I'm also now, once they see you're over 500 connections, they start, you get all these different people are trying to hit you up with different things, but there are still a lot of good people in that network. It's just a matter of, you know, figuring out how to make that work. So
I found a way of doing that. If you find a way of creating a network that's honestly and ethically totally committed to learning, development, growing as a group, let me know how you pull that off. Cause I've tried it through various mechanisms, Facebook groups, and eventually it still gets hijacked by people posting pictures of cats playing the piano. I haven't figured out a way of just focusing on learning and growth and development. If you find something, I think I'd want to be a part of it.
I'll definitely share it with you. I don't know if there's a way to protect, but thanks to all the privacy violations with Facebook and the like of the others, I'm pretty sure that's going to come down the pipeline at some point. So anyway, yeah. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule and sharing some great nuggets and insight. Great kudos to everything you're doing, and good luck for all your new initiatives that you're going to be working on in the second half of the year and beyond.
Thanks, Lynn. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can find us on Facebook for Love of the Game, Twitter, TLOTG Conference, and forlovethegame.ca. We'll see you next week for an all-new episode.